Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. We're straddling quite a fence here tonight. The first half of the show falls on Easter Sunday, of course, the last 2 hours of Easter Sunday, the Easter holiday anyway. Hope all of you had a wonderful day with your loved ones and family members. And the second half of the show falls on April Fool's Day, the beginning of April Fool's Day anyway. I promise no jokes here. We take this stuff seriously. The date on the calendar, 3/31/13, shouldn't that mean something? I don't know. I do know we have one heck of a program for you tonight. Some of the things that we are going to get into this evening will, I think, become news stories, mainstream news stories in the days and weeks ahead. Since I've been hosting this program on Sunday nights over the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Las Vegas businessman and space entrepreneur Bob Bigelow 3 times on this program. And each time he's dropped some heavy stuff on us, newsworthy stuff. Though most of the time, I think a lot of people either weren't listening or not paying close attention. It was on this program, so some of you may remember, that he announced reaching a deal with the FAA to obtain all the UFO reports that come into that government agency so that civilian researchers could look into them. And it was on this show that he announced the creation of a research organization known by the acronym BAS and its deal with MUFON to fund UFO research on the ground, boots on the ground research. Years later, I know there were conspiracy buffs who thought they'd uncovered this news themselves and were shocked by the government connections that Mr. Bigelow and his organization had, when the fact is he told us about them right here. And the last time he was here, he talked about problems with NASA and the likelihood that the Chinese would become the premier spacefaring nation on Earth, that they would probably get to the moon, claim the moon, before we get back there. A prediction that I think is sadly coming closer to being true every day. Tonight, starting in just a couple of minutes, I think we're going to make some news again. Bob Bigelow says he's ready to make an announcement about the future of space exploration and development, a new arrangement with NASA that could have tremendous importance for the future of space exploration, for our country, and eventually for our entire planet. But I also plan to ask Bob tonight about the idea of confirmation of a non-human presence. A lot of talk these days about disclosure, the need for the government to come clean. What if something is already underway, a different kind of long-term strategy? If anyone would know, it's our first guest, Bob Bigelow. In hour three, we are joined by another good friend of this program, Dr. Roger Lear, well known for his work performing surgery on persons who have these strange implants in their bodies. But he's here tonight to speak with us about a pretty spectacular incident, which he witnessed and which was videotaped, a UFO incident over Turkey that is one of the best documented cases ever. Webmaster Lex has posted the video on the Coast website, so you can take a look at it for yourself before we begin the conversation with Dr. Lear. Also there, our usual assortment of tidbits and oddities in the Knapp's news section. One story appropriate for Easter, new information about the Shroud of Turin. I don't know if George Norrie talked about this earlier in the week, just in case you didn't hear that, though. It turns out that scientific analysts say it really is. The Shroud really is old enough to have been around in the time of Christ. I know the Shroud remains controversial, but I'm always glad to read about scientific research into its authenticity. I think you'll enjoy the article. Another article posted tonight there is it looks at some developments in the UFO field, movies, entertainment. Every night we're bombarded with UFO and alien stuff. It's as if we're being conditioned to get ready for something. Perfect timing considering our first guest this evening. A couple of other stories about a comet that could be on a collision course with Mars, and one or two items from the worlds of science and technology that should be of interest to you. Fire up the coffee pot, strap yourselves in, cinch up those jammies, because we're just about ready to roll. Back in a moment with my first guest, Robert Bigelow. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. It was only a couple of years ago that Bob Bigelow founded Bigelow Aerospace, did it all with his own money, plunked a bunch of money down, took over something from NASA called inflatable space habitats, made them better, improved them to the point where they could become space stations of the future. They could be used in bases on the moon and Mars. Back in January of this year, he announced a deal with NASA to add one of his habitats to the International Space Station. And now Bob Bigelow is back with something even bigger to talk to us about. We're pleased to have him back on the program and pleased that he chose to break the news here. Bob, great to have you back.
Hey, George. It's super to be here. I always look forward to doing your show. And by the way, how's your ankle doing?
Yeah, don't tell people that stuff. I'll get all kinds of emails about it. But yeah, I'm doing all right.
Good.
You sent me this this contract a couple weeks ago, and it's just been driving me crazy that I couldn't say anything about it. You think normally about contracts with somebody like NASA, and you think, that's going to sound pretty boring. This one, however, is a blockbuster. I mean, talking about long-term stuff of exploring the solar system, what does this deal mean? How much can you tell about it, and how big is it?
I think it's fabulously exciting for our company, and we've been working on this for about nine or ten months, so it hasn't been just something that we generated up last week or last month. And I think we had worked together with NASA on this collectively, so this is a joint effort. This Space Act Agreement is, and I think it's potentially very, very meaningful for the country. And I think it helps to establish a new kind of breakthrough in being able to get things going.
And what does it say? I mean, lay it out for us.
Well, essentially, it starts out in the first part of the agreement as to purpose, that the purpose of the agreement is to facilitate and explore in a manner that that can facilitate commercial goals and objectives as well as the public goals and objectives to work together to provide facilities to allow people to work and live in space beyond LEO. So this agreement is substantially a document that looks to L1, L2, or cislunar orbit, or even a lunar base. And so there are some major excerpts in this agreement that are worth probably reading verbatim along the way here.
Well, I mean, let's jump into some of them, because I couldn't tell from reading this whether the agreement just applies to your company. I mean, this is obviously an agreement with your company, but it seems like it's setting the framework for something much bigger with a lot of other companies as well.
Well, in this type of agreement, the nature is that NASA has to, even though this is kind of a sole source contract or agreement, NASA has to say that it's non-exclusive. The fact of the matter is the architectures for habitable use, being the expandable systems that we've been working on for a long time, which have NASA heritage, of course, through the Transhab program, reside exclusively in our company through exclusive NASA licensing and then a number of our own patents and so forth. And there just is not another company in this country that has invested the time and money and acquired the level of progress that we have. So if NASA is going to use expandable systems, our company is the logical one to turn to. It just, you can't turn this on or off within just a year or two. There's too much R&D that's required.
You've really been tough on NASA, justifiably so. I mean, the last couple of times you've been here to talk to me, you've laid it out. What's wrong with NASA? That it's become sort of a jobs protection program. It doesn't do a very good job of developing new space systems. It allowed the shuttle to expire without anything to replace it. What changed?
Well, all that is true. But there are some key differences between NASA of 8 or 10 years ago and beyond, and prior to that, and since that time to the present time. Two of those things have to do with programs that NASA has initiated that are extremely important. One was called the COTS program, which was a program using government money to fund private sector development of efficient rockets. And that has worked very well in the case of SpaceX. And then the more recent program starting about 3 years ago was the Commercial Crew Development Program, CCDEV. And we're in the third year of that. And Boeing, Sierra Nevada, and SpaceX are the prime beneficiaries of that program now. About $1.1 billion was allocated among those companies last year, and late last year. And so that has changed the kind of architecture of what NASA is all about. They still, in my opinion, have a lot more folks than they probably need, which is not a popular thing to say, obviously, but I don't think they need 18,000 people. So there are certain aspects to that that frustrate a lot of NASA managers. And I think that people need to understand that in some ways, NASA can't help being what it is because the politics of this country. And that's an extremely powerful element. Is you have to, as an agency, you have to behave as you politically need to behave. So those two programs have been very fundamental in allowing NASA to be able to get off of the Russian dependency on carrying our crews to ISS, which costs $63 million a seat at the present time. And I understand it's going to be in the 70-some million dollar range here with perhaps in just a few months.
Help me understand what this agreement means in a practical sense, though. Does it mean that we're more likely to have a base on the moon, that we're going to go to Mars? Does it make it cheaper for NASA to do things? I mean, I ask it in this context. The primary criticism you've had of NASA in the past is that they won't get out of the way. Is this basically NASA saying, we'll get out of the way and help private enterprise go ahead and develop things for space?
Well, I don't, frankly, to be really honest with you, I don't think this agreement would have been possible if NASA were not in a very difficult financial situation, at least as they perceive it. Not that having $16.5 billion makes you poor, and that's the amount after sequestration has occurred here. So, but I think the way NASA spends money and the way that the obligations are loaded on NASA, it does not have, legitimately, does not have money to go out and do exploration work. And so they have been looking for ways in which to accomplish that. And one of the ways here that we've come up with is to work together with the private sector. And if the private sector can avail itself of commercial use of some of these platforms, then I think we can be induced to offer costs and services to NASA that otherwise would never be achievable. So I think it's a classic opportunity for a very logical partnership to occur. So Bigelow Aerospace is kind of being used as the tool to gather together a number of major aerospace companies in this country and create identification of the folks who can contribute what kind of hardware and identify time frames for that and costs, and then orchestrate the various kinds of missions that otherwise NASA would not be able to afford.
What kind of time frame?
Well,
it seems like it's just a couple of years, right? You're looking at a plan that's going to be put into effect in just a couple of years.
Well, there's the time frame that's part and parcel of this Space Act agreement, which is fairly short. Gate 1, which is an asset identification a challenge to identify all the different assets, is a 100-day clock, and that's calendar days. And then when that report is finished and all the players have been identified and what they're going to contribute, then the mission scenario clock begins, and that's 120 days following the first gate. So they're essentially what they call two gates in this effort. And at the conclusion of the second gate, NASA then is given a variety of scenarios that the private sector says it will support financially and time-wise and deliver these on a fixed-price basis. And NASA may also be able to choose between whether to actually buy those facilities outright or lease those facilities. So it would further really encourage the savings dollar-wise for NASA with the scenario of leasing. And concurrent with that is the notion that NASA would be involved in allowing the commercial sector for granting these concessions, some kinds of opportunities. Still a TBD, to be determined kind of situation, but there would be opportunities that would be requested in conjunction with these kinds of concessions, and then it would be NASA's would look at the menus and decide how to combine these kinds of menus in its own best interest. And that's kind of the guiding thing here, George, is first that none of this will work if it isn't successful for NASA. That has to be understood, that NASA is the customer. NASA is the entity right now that for the first objective here, it has to be satisfied. And then secondarily, we say, okay, if this is a good thing for NASA, and we were in NASA's shoes, we would do the same thing for ourselves if we were in their shoes. And then what comes second is, okay, how can the private sector benefit off of this? Because a lot of the companies aren't going to be asked to lose money, but they're going to be told very bluntly, you better not be making much off of this, and we're going to know. And because we're a general contractor in this effort here, so we're going to know. We subcontract out to an awful lot of people, a lot of companies. So we don't manufacture everything in-house ourselves. We behave as a general contractor. So at least half of everything that we put into our spacecraft are things and items and hardware that we buy from other folks. It might be Boeing. It could be SpaceX. It's a major companies, major aerospace companies. So we're used to dealing with these people for our own aerospace needs. And we're going to say, look, we're not asking you here to lose money. And that isn't going to work either. But we're saying you better cut your profit margin really slim, and in return, maybe then we have something that we can work with NASA on where they can sort of timeshare, or they can give us certain kinds of benefits in return for these kinds of concessions.
Because frankly, I mean, you and I have talked about it privately, but some of these companies, and maybe you don't want to tick off your future partners or something, but some of these companies have really been gutting NASA, really fleecing them for big chunks of money, haven't they?
Well, you know, that's the nature of government contracting, and I think, yes, that's correct. And it has been going on for decades, and I think it is applicable to all areas, whether it's the Air Force or whether it's military or NASA. I think it's the nature of the government beast, that whenever you're spending other people's money, you're obviously not going to care about it like it would be if it were your own dollar. So that has been a habitual kind of problem that has always been there. And I think that's one of the ingredients here, is that we're going to damn well care about what is spent, and because this isn't going to work unless we can beat the time frames that NASA is used to, and we can beat the kinds of cost paradigms that NASA is used to by at least an order of magnitude.
It sort of sounds like from the agreement that it puts your company in the catbird seat. I mean, NASA said, we want you to go out and sort of survey the landscape and decide who's a good contributor and who isn't.
Well, we have the habitats, which again are you know, those are NASA heritage with the Transhab system. So you start with those kinds of structures, and we can make NASA some very good deals on those kinds of space structures. We can make some concessions and make it impossible, we hope, for NASA to say no. At least that's our objective. You know, we're going to be very aggressive in trying to the good news is we're going to have two of our 330s ready to launch to ship out of Las Vegas within the year of 2016. And the bad news is we're going to have two VA-330s to ship out in the year 2016. So, you know, we're going to be scrambling to queue up more spacecraft in our plant. And we've just finished a major addition to our plant, so that was in kind of anticipation of hopefully having something that we were going to need it for. And so that's what we intend to do. We intended to be there to deliver that hardware and those services. And just like the Beam Project, we expect NASA to to be involved in oversight and looking at what we're doing and looking at our testing regime. So we have a lot of confidence in our spacecraft and our ability to perform, and I think that's an attractive thing to NASA.
Well, you made this announcement in January about a deal to add one of your habitats to the International Space Station. And at the same time, as you mentioned, you made an announcement that you're basically going to build your own space station that'll be ready to go in 2016. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about how it's going to get up there. We're talking with Bob Bigelow, founder of Bigelow Aerospace, and a guy who's probably given more money to UFO research than any person in the history of the world. We'll be talking about UFO-related matters in Hour 2. When we come back, however, I want to get back into a discussion of his plans for building his own space station, how it'll get up there, and does this change the equation? Do we have a chance of thwarting the idea of the Chinese getting back and laying claim to the moon before we can get back there? We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Bob Bigelow, as noted earlier, you've had sort of an up and down, back and forth relationship with NASA. I mean, you've dug into your own pocket to expand your company. Big time. I mean, you expanded the plant, you hired a bunch of people, and then you had to contract because the deal you thought you had with NASA didn't happen. Now you said back in January you announced this new deal to add one of your space habitat, your modules to the ISS, and at the same time you said you're willing to spend $250 million to essentially build your own space station. But right now you don't have a way to get it up there, right?
Well, you're short of on the money by about 50%. The 250 has already been spent.
Oh man!
So you're looking at maybe a you know, double that, another 250. But I think the we've always been hostage to the taxi service and transportation. We knew that when we started the company, and we didn't get into the rocket side of things because that's where already a lot of people were operating and working. So. And you can't fight a two-front war. There's no way that you can take on the challenge of both destinations and transportation. So we're encouraged, though, that NASA, over the last half dozen, 7-8 years, has really stimulated the, maybe not to the extent that the Augustine Commission had advised the White House and Congress, that and actually Congress is the one that didn't appropriate enough monies, but nevertheless, a lot of money has already been spent and devoted and given to these other companies for rocket development and taxi development. And without that, even this agreement today would not be possible. The Space Act agreement that we have here right now would not be possible. So we have to give credit to NASA for promoting those two programs, which have been very, very important and maybe will make all the difference in whether or not we even have a chance to get to the moon before the Chinese welcome us there.
We'll come back to Chinese in a second. Back to the idea of having a launch capability. What does this new framework from NASA mean for a company like SpaceX and for you? Because I know, you know, your first two space capsules, the spacecraft that are up there floating around now, you had to go to Russia, pay a big chunk of money to get them launched up there. And the Russians have kept jacking up the price, I guess, to a point where they're almost priced out. But does this new framework help a company like SpaceX and then ultimately help you because it's a way for you to get your new modules up there?
I think everybody has helped, George. I think this is almost like a perfect storm. It's a win-win for everybody. It's a win-win for the government in pricing and being able to have programs that can be executed within much shorter time frames. It's a win for Bigelow Aerospace if we can get our modules into play for our own country instead of just leasing them or renting them to foreign national countries. And for SpaceX, for launch providers. So I think if this works, it's going to be a win all the way around. And I think it can work. That's the interesting thing about this, that the pieces are already in play to make this a real possibility.
I mentioned earlier very briefly that there's a phrase in this contract, this deal you signed with NASA, that just jumps right out at me. And it talks about exploring the solar system. That's exciting language to see NASA talking about ambitious plans again. It's been so long since it seemed like they had a vision. And I want you, if you would take a minute or two to sort of paint a broad picture of what this could mean, how far we could go if everything works as planned, what it would be like 50 years from now, where we would be.
Wow, that's a big jump, 50 years.
Well, 20 years.
Okay. So the philosophy here is that if commercial industry can provide the support systems for an agency like NASA to use at a significantly reduced cost, because the commercial industry is also using them commercially, then NASA can do the kinds of things that the commercial industry doesn't want to do and is premature. So that means that if the commercial industry can provide the kind of locations and transportation to L1, L2, L1, you know, is 85% of the way between Earth and the moon. L2 is beyond the other side of the moon, is out maybe 330 or 50,000 miles. And cislunar orbit is putting a platform in orbit around the moon so that it could function as a depot for a lunar base. Those are all potentially near-term goals. And in fact, NASA alludes to that in the agreement here. It says, in addition, this agreement is coupled with private sector long-term plans beyond low Earth orbit operations, including those of Bigelow Aerospace, to place a lunar base on the surface of the moon. The parties hereby agree to embark on a series of phased activities. And so that is, we're making no bones about it, that that's what we're out to try to accomplish.
Wow.
Now, beyond that, you know, NASA then can make plans to go to Mars, and that's a big jump. That is something huge, and we're excited about that also. We're in these various scenarios. We're helping to put the Orion spacecraft and the SLS super launch system to good use. Those are currently very expensive programs, and Boeing has the SLS system for a Super Heavy, and it's costing billions per year to NASA. It really doesn't have viable destinations, and that's one of the main problems. It doesn't have really any place to go. Same way with the Orion. The Orion has been running, I think, up to around $8 billion, $9 billion so far. And it doesn't really have adequate destinations either. They talk about going to asteroids, but that's really a stunt. And it's not really, it's misleading the public as to the fact that the architecture without an expandable system, for example, or a large spacecraft for people to occupy on the way in and way out, you can't keep the crew members alive on the way back to Earth. So if the architecture was to put two Orions together nose to nose, put a couple people in them, and send them out on a several month voyage, well, you can't stock enough consumables, and you can't deal with the human waste on that long a voyage. So they would probably not be alive on the way home. But the efficacy of these kinds of options and missions that we're hoping to create and that NASA is working with us on can help give really practical use to the Orion, which is a good idea. It's a good spacecraft. The marketing of that had to, I guess, take a little bit of a turn that maybe sometimes in order to get things sold, maybe the line isn't straight line from A to B. Maybe there are kind of detours, but in the long run, it needs to happen. SpaceX also plans to have a reentry vehicle of its own. And the Super Heavy, which right now is a 70 metric ton lifter, may migrate to 130 metric tons, doesn't really have an efficacious mission. It has nowhere to really go. So that's the point, is that if you're going to migrate up to larger and larger boosters, and so they can handle larger and larger spacecraft, so you can go to more distant places, that all kind of fits. We have another generation spacecraft beyond the 330. The VA-330 stands for 330 cubic meters of volume. And to give your audience a reference point, the largest module on the ISS is 110 cubic meters. So it's a substantial boost. But the Super Heavy rockets that Marshall is currently, and Huntsville are currently developing, at 70 metric tons, 130 metric tons, can lift something really exciting that we're working on for the future. We call it Olympus. And one Olympus is 2,250 cubic meters.
Wow, that's big.
That one spacecraft alone is double the volume of the International Space Station, which is at 1,100 meters.
Okay, everything goes well. 3 years from now, you will have built basically your own private space station. And if all goes well, SpaceX, a company like that, could have the capability of getting it up there. But what happens when it's up there? Who is your likely customer? Who's the end user?
Right now, we're not sure. I would personally like to have NASA be the first user of what we make and what we build would stay in this country. We have been marketing ourselves and doing quite well until this recession came along, and that kind of slowed everything up and everybody up, including nations who were barely hanging on by their fingernails and trying to avoid bankruptcy and stay solvent. And now a number of countries are getting back on their feet, and we are starting to engage with these people, the Mideast, the folks who have the oil were not beat up as severely. Other folks are also reacquiring their financial wherewithal. So their space programs had to take a back seat to making sure they were, you know, metaphorically putting food on the table for their citizenry. And that came first, of course, logically so. And so we potentially could have our first vehicle spoken for by foreign consumers and foreign customers. And that's a possibility. My own preference is I would like it to be NASA.
Let's talk about the Chinese. The last time you were here, you and I had a conversation about the likelihood that if and when the U.S. gets back to the moon, chances are pretty good the Chinese would be there to greet us. And in the interim, in the year or so since then, we've seen one story after another out of China where they're really jumping into space in leaps and bounds, making significant progress. Does this new agreement with NASA change that equation at all? Is it still likely that when we get to the moon, if we go back, that the Chinese will be there first? And how important is that?
I think this new agreement has a chance to play a role and to have a positive effect. If the heavy, you have to remember that the Saturn V, excuse me, was a heavy lifter. That was a major, huge rocket, and it takes a rocket of that size to execute lunar missions with people on board. And if we don't succeed in continuing these heavy booster programs, if they should go on for a few years, Boeing continues to operate these, you know, the development effort, and then Congress cuts the funding because Congress can't see, well, what's the point? Where are these rockets going to go? What are they going to lift, and where are they going to take it? And gee, we've already been to the moon. We've been there and done that. What's the point here? The programs could be canceled. That means the United States would have nothing that would be part of the SLS current program to combat what the Chinese might put together. And they are working on heavy lifters of their own. They have. I mean super heavy, not just normal heavy, but the super heavy, which I think they are looking at also ultimately having 130 metric ton booster, which is about what the Saturn V was. So the answer is yes, George. If things don't change and we continue to go the way we are, America's not going to be competitive. We won't have the lifting systems, and because we're too poor. So it gets back to this recession has beat up everybody here in this country and around the world, including our own government. So it's more than just the problems with national debt. It's that we don't have the money to be able to go do these kinds of things. And I think, and I have said for a couple of years in public and different lectures, I've given speeches to different groups, a mixture of government people and military people, that I really see that there's nothing really to stop the Chinese if they do want to ultimately lay claim actual ownership to the moon. And that's not, and that the 67 treaty notwithstanding, that is not going to be something that's going to be in their way. So Article 16 is something they could exercise and completely eliminate any obligation to that 67 treaty. So it's a really big deal.
Well, I mean, the impact of that, though, does it mean we would have to have Chinese permission to land on the moon? And psychologically, what it would mean to Americans to look up at a full moon and realize that's China.
Yeah, I think psychologically, even though, you know, you have helium-3 there, which is like piles of diamonds in terms of its value from an energy standpoint, it's extremely valuable if it can be harvested and exported and for fusion purposes. But, and that will change the entire paradigm for fossil fuels, getting away from fossil fuels, and because about 25 tons, metric tons of that can supply all the United States needs for a year. And the estimates are that there are anywhere from 1 million to 20 million metric tons of helium-3 on that body. So the Chinese could have exclusivity to that and dictate a lot of the energy's future, the Earth's future energy-wise. But this, as you point out here, the psychological damage would be enormous. I don't think it's something that the United States could ever recover from. And it's something that maybe only comes along at once every couple, two or three millennia for a nation to be able to see something and have an opportunity that they either create or kind of falls in their lap to create that kind of dynamic. Because, like you say, if you're looking at that body and you know that the Chinese government owns the moon, it's an enormous psychological boost in their favor in the eyes of everybody else on this planet. And that would last not for decades, not for hundreds of years. It would last until somebody else acquired a comparable coup on another body, like Mars. But then again, you'd say, well, gee, who's odds-on favorite to get to Mars and repeat the process? It would probably be the Chinese. So the psychological benefits would be enormous, and they would be indisputably the world's number one power if in fact, in a few years, they're not able to already make that claim.
You know, it's the last couple of years, it seems like America's spunk has gone and that we're just in a real funk. And I remember the flip side of this discussion is back as a kid watching those moon launches and all the launches and how inspirational it was, how exciting it was for our country and us as Americans. It just seems like that could come back. You could get that mojo back again with a shot in the arm to a space program. Give us something to do. We are spacefaring people.
I agree, George. I think it's a function of getting private sector companies involved, having them have some skin in the game. That's part of the idea of this agreement, is that they're going to try to, you know, bend over backwards to make things affordable and really cut costs. And I think it's there hasn't been a lot of excitement in over the last few decades. The shuttle flights became routine, and the ISS became kind of routine. So the public is looking for something else that's more exciting and more dramatic. And other destinations and locations can certainly help that.
We appreciate you sharing with us this sneak peek of what's to come. The first announcement about your deal with NASA. When is this going to be rolled out? When is there going to be some sort of a formal announcement that the rest of the world gets to hear about it?
Well, we've been given five dates, either April 10th, 11th, or 12th, or possibly 17th or 18th, where in Washington at NASA headquarters they will hold a press conference. And this will be announced at that location. And NASA, according to the agreement here, is obligated to provide support in highlighting this agreement and supporting Bigelow Aerospace and its efforts to try to conclude successfully these two gates, these two A and B assignments.
Well, it's really exciting, Bob. Really appreciate you talking to us about this. We're going to shift gears in the next segment, but anything else to say about the agreement that you want to pass along to Coast to Coast listeners?
Well, I think, you know, it's a shame that there is so much in this agreement to be excited about, and where there isn't, of course, time to cover it in more detail, but I think that if the public understood and could see the body of this agreement and could read it for themselves, that they would be very excited that this kind of change is possible, garnering together a lot of private commercial companies in this kind of a joint effort.
Well, I'll tell you what, Bob, when you give me the green light, I'll post it so everybody can read the thing for themselves. We'll come back in just a moment to talk about the possibility of confirmation. Confirmation of what, you ask? I think you know.